Well, hello, runners. Welcome to episode 26 of the I Run Things podcast, the podcast for the everyday runner in search for that extra bit of motivation to get out there. My name is Zuzi, and I am your host. In today's episode, we chat with Chris Seymour. Chris ran the Marathon Grand Slam, also known as 7 Marathons on 7 Continents, plus a marathon in the North Pole, while raising funds for metachromatic leukodystrophy, or MLD for short, a very rare disease that only around 41,000 people in the world are living with. All the scoop about this challenge, with a special emphasis on the North Pole Marathon, will be in this episode. And if you enjoyed these kind of crazy adventures, you might want to listen to episode number 24, in which we chat with Tony Billups. Tony was one of the 27 African-American athletes to run either a full marathon or a half on the continent of Antarctica at the beginning of this crazy year that 2020 has turned out to be. Again, that is episode number 24. And now, this is a very long interview with Chris about the Marathon Grand Slam Challenge. So without further ado, let's play the interview with Chris. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well, Zuzi. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Before we started recording this, you said that in New Zealand, where you are, it's snowing today.
Yeah, which is
awesome.
Yeah, I live in the Southern Alps in Queenstown, New Zealand, and we're known for it being a very adventurous town, lots of snowboarding and trail running and mountain running, and haven't actually had snow at our house this entire winter, and it's just clicked over into spring, and we're getting the first snowfall. I'm looking out the window right now and watching the snow fall, and also wondering, like, oh, how am I going to get up the mountain later today and go snowboarding maybe, or go for a good snowy run? So I've got my trusty steam seal jacket out just in case I decide to go for a run out in the snow after we have our chat.
Oh, I'm so jealous right now. Okay, so I wanted you to introduce yourself first and foremost.
Yeah, so my name's Chris Seymour. I'm originally from Houston, Texas in the U.S., but I've lived in Australia and New Zealand for about the past 11 years. And I started kind of a crazy journey of running about in 2013. And actually ran my first half marathon in the middle of the Australian outback at Ayers Rock at Uluru. And it was almost like a dare. One of my coworkers was like, oh, I'm going out to Uluru to run a half marathon. You should go. And I was like, okay, you know, her name was Karen, and I was like, okay, Karen, let's go do that. And then started training for it, and then Karen ends up getting a hurt ankle and drops out of the race, and then it was just me and my wife going by ourselves, and started this crazy journey of running ridiculously long distances in sometimes ridiculous places. So
yeah. I know, and you and I connected over on Facebook. Because you completed your seven marathons in 7 continents.
Yes.
Plus, yeah, because I was asking about that. And then you actually said, well, I've done the seven marathons in 7 continents. And I, plus on top of that, had done a marathon on the North Pole. And I was like, blown away.
Yeah. So that's what's affectionately known as the Marathon Grand Slam. So there's the 7 Continents Club, and then they call it the Marathon Grand Slam Club, and that's to do all 7 continents and then top it off with the North Pole. So, yeah.
So,
I did that over 2015 and finished in 2017 at the North Pole. Yeah.
So it only took you 2 years.
3 years. Yeah, 15, 16, and 17. Yeah.
Okay, so 3 years. It's just the amount of time it took you is, to me, is in and of itself, it's incredible. because
some people do it in 7 days. So
well, yeah, so that's not, those are like not many people.
Yeah, that's just, true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So how did you decide that that's something you wanted to do? The seven.
Yeah. So funny enough, like I said, it all started out at Uluru and in the Outback. So we ran this, the Australian Outback Marathon, and I did the half marathon, and afterwards they have this amazing dinner, under the stars in the middle of the Outback. And it's just this amazing celebration that they have. And they sit you down at, you know, you kind of get randomly put at tables with other runners, and there are a couple of, we'll call them veteran runners. They were, they were sitting at the table with us, and they started talking about, this was continent number 7 for me. I finished that. And I thought they meant that they had just traveled to all 7 continents, because I know a lot of people have that goal. In fact, my wife and I, when we got married, we set out a goal just to go to all 7 continents, and we did. And so I was like, oh, I've been to all 7 continents. And they were like, oh, well, what races did you do? And I was like, none. Actually, this is my, I was like, we just traveled. He's like, oh, no, son, we've just finished 7 marathons on 7 continents. And then the wheels started kind of turning, like, oh, that's a pretty crazy thing to do. And I didn't put a whole lot of like thought to it at the time, because I hadn't even run my first full marathon at that point. I had signed up for this half marathon. Then I had one of my employees at the time, he was on like a weight loss journey, and he was saying, oh, I want to run my first half marathon. And he was going to do it in Melbourne, Australia, which is one of the bigger cities in Australia. And, cause that's where he lived. And I looked at that, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. He's doing that. I was like, what can I do to motivate my employee, you know, be a good boss? I said, okay, well, all right, man, if you do your first, half marathon, I'll do my first full marathon. total amateur, not realizing a tale of two different races completely. But I thought, oh, that finishes in the Melbourne Cricket Ground. It's a massive stadium. That looks really cool. So we did it. And so then I went off and I did my first marathon. You know, I had that wake up call of, oh, what's it like to run a half versus a full? Learned the hard way.
Right.
And then shortly after that, my niece became diagnosed with a very rare brain disease. It's a white matter degenerative lysosomal disease called metachromatic leukodystrophy, or MLD for short. And she lives in Houston. I'm living halfway around the world. And it was like, what can I do to help my niece out? And so I kind of thought back to, you always see people fundraising for doing races, you know, there's things like Race for the Cure and, you know, a million different races and charities out there. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I could run 7 marathons on 7 continents and get people's awareness for this rare disease and do some fundraising for some of the different organizations that did it. So I went through the next year kind of still putting that stuff through my head. And this was in 2014. Did a couple more marathons, started to kind of get the feel for it. So I'd probably done about maybe 4 marathons at the time, over a course of time. I'd done run in Sydney and the Gold Coast and here in Queenstown in New Zealand where I live and now. And then I just started mapping out the plan and then worked with my with my family and a couple of the charities and then February 2015 it all kicked off at the Tokyo Marathon. So yeah, and then that was 3 years of a lot of running. so
which ones did you do for the challenge?
Okay, yeah, so like I said, so February 2015 kicked off at the Tokyo Marathon, which that was I had set an unofficial goal to break sub 4 hours. I'd never done less than 4 hours, so squeaked in at like 3 hours 58 minutes. So it was a win, and it was a it was a rainy day in Tokyo, but it made it happen. That was really great. And then it was April of 2015, went and did Paris, and that was a total opposite day. Instead of being rainy and cold, it was like hot and sweltering in Paris, and And so amazing race. You know, you're running through the streets of Paris and you're looking over and it's like Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, you know, Notre Dame, all these things. Yeah. It's a pretty special, special race. And it's a massive race. I had no idea how big it was. I think there was like 40 or 50,000 people in that race. So that was pretty special. Didn't squeak under 4 hours that one. That one was a hard one. So, then I had a bit of a change in plans. I was supposed to have gone back to the Australian Outback Marathon because I was going to tick off another Australia one to kind of make it all seven within this plan. So flying to Uluru from Sydney, and all of a sudden about 30 minutes before landing, pilot comes on. We think, oh, this is the pilot coming on saying, you know, like usual, we're about to make our descent. We're about to do all of this.
It's sunny.
He comes on and he says, hello. Unfortunately, we're having a malfunction and we can't land in the middle of the outback because there's no way to fix the plane. So we've got to turn around 3 hours and go all the way back to Sydney and land. Everyone on that plane was a runner in that race, and the race was the next day. And so they turned us all the way around, go 3 hours back to Sydney. And we're like, okay, so we're waiting in the airport. And they're like, sorry, we can't get you out until tomorrow. And we can't get you out until tomorrow at 1 p.m., which means we're going to land in Uluru at 3 or 4 p.m. That local time. So unfortunately, that race got canceled. And so what I did is I said, okay, well, 2 months later was the Sydney Marathon, and I had done the Sydney Marathon once before, the year before. That was one of the races I had trained in 2014. And so I said, all right, well, missed out on this one. We're going to change course. Went to the Sydney Marathon. I trained really, really hard. And I wanted to really break my PB, and I set myself a goal of 3:45 and came in at about 3:36. And so I was really, really stoked on that one.
That's awesome.
So I used that motivation of, I can't believe, you know, I didn't get to go run in Uluru. I'm going to go out and I'm going to just put a massive effort into it. So that was a really cool day. And the Sydney Marathon is an amazing race. I was lucky enough to live in Sydney for a number of years and ran it. I ran that and a half, probably a handful of times, maybe about 4 or 5 times. And, you know, you start off on the North Sydney, and you run across Sydney Harbour Bridge, which is just, you know, iconic. And, you know, you look off into the harbor and you can see the Opera House and everything. It's beautiful. And you run through the city and you actually finish on the grounds of the Sydney Opera House. So it's pretty special race.
Give me the chills.
Yeah, it's a pretty special race. So I highly suggest it. It's quite an undulating course. So it's not the best course to go for if you're going for a PB in Australia, but if you want just iconic Australia city, that's the race to do. So that was September of 2015, and then in November of 2015, went to New York and ran the New York Marathon. And unfortunately, after the Sydney race, I had kind of had a little bit of a calf strain, and I didn't get to train super well. And then, you know, you do overseas flights, and I do a lot of overseas flights for work. I just, on an overseas flight, I think I just, you know, sitting funny in an economy class seat, my back was just like all sore, and I tried to get it worked out, and I just didn't go 100% into the New York Marathon. But it was like, it's New York,
right?
You get a place in New York, even if you're like 80%, give it a go. And so did that. And
so how did you get into New York City? Did you get
that one I actually went through a travel company. In this part of the world, there's a lot of companies that do tours. And I went through a company called Traveling Fit that's based out of Australia. And they take a group of probably 100 or so Australian runners out. So I was lucky enough to get a spot with them. And
very cool.
Yeah, so did New York. It was pretty great because we had a family friend. My wife's family's from Long Island originally, and we had some family friends that came in for it, and one of the family members was also running, and so she ran it too. So it was kind of cool afterwards. Got to catch up with some family we hadn't seen in a long time, and for anyone that's run New York knows how special of a race that is. I mean, that's just, yeah. I think it's the largest, you know, city marathon in the world. So it's one thing. So yeah. So that was, so 2015 is kind of what I termed my traditional races for the year. And then 2016 started what I'd call the more non-traditional or extreme races of this challenge to do seven marathons on seven continents. And so took the first half of the year and really kind of just recovered, did some small races, did some half marathons, did a few trail races here in New Zealand, just little things. And then in June of 2016, I went to South Africa and did the Big Five Marathon.
I have it on my bucket list.
Yeah, well, you should definitely do it. And it's one of those races that is organized by the Danish company Albatross Adventure Tours, and they do a lot of big races like the Petra Marathon and the Bagan Temple in Myanmar and Great Wall of China, and they do one in Greenland, the Polar Circle. And then Big Five was one, and I thought to myself, like, okay, that would be pretty cool because it's on a private game reserve. And I had looked at some other races and like the Comrades, and I wasn't ready to go up to a full like ultra marathon yet. So I was like, right, okay, right. This looks like the good one to do. Let's keep it simple. and it's a surprise. Well, I shouldn't say surprising. If you pay attention to all of the maps of the course and their website, it's a challenging course, and it's at altitude, so it's probably about 1,500 meters, so about almost a mile up, so about 5,000 feet or so. So it was an incredible race. You start, we're standing there at the start line, and the race organizer's like, okay, it's a beautiful day for the race, and it was. He's like, but we have one change. We've had to modify the course this morning at the last minute. And everyone's like, wow, wonder what that's about. Oh yeah, well, a lion made a kill of an impala on our course, so, and he's there, grazing on this on his kill, and he's keeping an eye on it. So we're gonna have to divert you a couple k's this way, and then come back around, and you're gonna do an extra loop of this section just to get your distance in, and then we'll send you into the rest of the race. So then that was the moment where you're like, yep, we're in Africa.
Right.
this is gonna be a wild race, literally. And so you run you're running through this bush, the African bush, and at one point, there was a whole group of wildebeest that just ran by, and you saw hippos and giraffes and everything just in the distance. And the game wardens, they kept they kept an eye on the big cats and the rhinos and certain, and this, and they, the hippos can be a bit furious, right? At times. Yeah. So they were keeping an eye on the lake, but still you did run by a lake and you saw their little heads popping out of the water in the distance. And it's like, there was a guy there like, oh, look at the hippos. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to keep running. but probably one of the more special things is a lot of the locals were manning the aid stations, and they'd have their traditional drums, or they'd be singing traditional South African songs. And, I pulled out my camera at one point and just took a video. I was running into there because it was so uplifting. And it was obviously towards the end of a hard race of the race. So it was pretty special. But the one thing it had about a 1K just uphill climb that it wasn't runnable at all. I mean, everyone you see in the video, they're just, trying to power hike up it, but it was it's a tough race, but it is a beautiful race and an amazing race to do, and highly suggest it as well. So that was the middle of the year in 2016. And then I went and I did something crazy, which was run probably two of the hardest races a week apart from one another. Maybe it was about 10 days apart from one another. So a group called Polar Running Adventures organizes the Antarctic Ice Marathon and the North Pole Marathon. And they also organize another race called the Volcano Marathon, which is in the Atacama Desert in Chile.
Oh, wow.
And so the Atacama Desert in Chile, it looks like you're on Mars, to be honest. That's the only way I can really describe it. It's the driest desert in the world outside of Antarctica, because a lot of people don't realize that Antarctica is a desert, but it is.
Right.
So there's a small town called San Pedro de Atacama. And so this race starts at 4,300 meters of altitude, which is about 14,000 feet high. That's in the driest desert of the world. So you've got desert, altitude, and you're running a marathon in that. So that's kind of a trifecta of difficulty
right there.
And so, you know, so running this race, and it is just, you know, it's incredible. And you had to run in full trail gear. So we had to carry 2 liters of water. We had to, you know, I carried some little candies that were made with coca leaf in it just because of the altitude. And I remember, you know, eating them and kind of, you know, having those during the race. And, but you know, you're running through this and there's llamas in the distance and there's, you know, there's not a lot of life up there, but, you know, you'd see like a little vicuña, which is like a rabbit or that. And it was pretty cool because we crossed the Tropic of Capricorn, while we were down there. There's a big marker and you cross that. And it was, it was one of the toughest things that I had done to that time. And, you know, going through it, you know, there were some people that had already run the Antarctic race a few years before. And they're like, oh, Antarctica is way easier than this race. You're going to have fun. And I'm like, you know, is it really? Like, and, but it was, it was an incredible race. But leading the months up into that, I had gone to a gym that had a special altitude chamber. So it had a room with reduced oxygen. And so I ran 2 or 3 times a week on this treadmill at reduced oxygen. And I'm very glad that I did, because I think that it made a difference and I was able to get through it. I mean, it was very tough, got through it though. And that one was pretty cool because my wife was helping out at the end, and she was able to put my medal on me on that one. So that was pretty cool. And made a lot of good friends on that race, still to this day. Two of those friends were also at the North Pole, which we'll talk about in a minute. But yeah, so then about 10 days later, took a quick break, went to, had a little bit of a city break in Buenos Aires with my wife. And then she had to depart because she had to go back to work. I had had a lot of vacation that I had saved up for. And so I was spending the whole month in South America and Antarctica, but she had to go back to work. So she departed, went down to Tierra del Fuego in Chile, down to a little town called Punta Arena, which is where a lot of Antarctic flights leave from. So to go down, you know, there's a couple of races in Antarctica. There's, you know, the Antarctic Ice Marathon, which is the one that I did, and that's at Union Glacier, which is the only private camp that's in Antarctica. So it's run by an American and Canadian group that's based out of Utah. So they're the only private group. And a lot of people, when they go on Antarctic expeditions, like if they're going to ski across Antarctica, or they're going to do, they're going to take a small flight to the South Pole or something like that, that's typically where they depart from, is from Union Glacier. So I chose that race because it's actually within the interior of Antarctica. The funny thing about Antarctic marathons is they get a little bit, there's a little bit of controversy around them, because there's basically 3 public races that you can do, which is the Antarctic Ice Marathon, and then there's 2 that are on King George Island. I think one's called called the Antarctic Marathon. I think the other one's called the Last Continent Marathon or something like that. And they're on King George Island, and those islands are in the South Shetlands, and they're outside the Antarctic Circle. So you get some Antarctic purists that are kind of like, it's not Antarctica because it's outside of the Antarctic Circle. So I was kind of like, when I was looking at that, I'd already been to Antarctica. So one of the big draw points of those other races going to King George Island is you're running with penguins, but you know, the challenge of it is that you have to take the ship down through the Drake Passage. So you're on an icebreaker ship and you're going through that. And the Drake Passage is like one of the worst bodies of water to sail through in the world. And you come around Cape Horn, which is notorious for being a really harsh body of water. So I had already done that. And I thought to myself, well, I've already done that. I got pretty seasick all the way home. I was like, I don't necessarily want to do that again. Because they say there's, they call it like you either get the Drake Lake or the Drake Shake. And on the way down to Antarctica on this one trip, we had the Drake Lake. And on the way back up from Antarctica, we had the Drake Shake. And I didn't necessarily want to do that again. I had my penguin and seals and whales experience on a previous trip. So I was like, look, I want to avoid controversy of saying, oh, did I actually do it? And just know to myself, yep, I was on the continent. I did it. And then avoid getting seasick again. And so I went with the Antarctic Ice Marathon, so which you fly down there and land on a massive blue ice runway. And it's an incredible situation. So there's these, we flew on a Russian Ilyushin 76 plane, which is a big cargo plane. And these pilots, these Russian pilots are just incredible because they, you know, they can navigate into this harsh environment, land on this massive sheet of ice effectively, and get you in and out of there safely enough.
We'll be right back with Chris, but I wanted to take a moment to remind you to please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. This helps our show grow and keeps me motivated to find interesting people with amazing and inspiring stories such as Chris's. Also, if you think your friends could benefit from listening to our content, share the podcast with your friends on social media or send them a link to your favorite episode. And now, back to the interview with Chris.
So you come in and you land on this blue ice runway, and then the team from Antarctic Logistics and Expeditions, and they're the team that actually manages Union Glacier, they come in and they pick you up in some four-wheel drive big vans and take you to Union Glacier camp. And you know, it's an amazing setup. I mean, it's definitely a I'll call it an Antarctic explorer type of experience, versus when you're on the ship, you know, yep, you go out into the cold, you go out and everything, but then you come into the warm ship and it's like, oh, I've got all these, you know, creature comforts that you need to do all that stuff. And Union Glacier, it's still it's a very nice camp, but it is a camp. You know, you are in tents, right? I mean, we slept in tents on the glacier, right? And, you know, they do have a couple of like a dining tent and some different tents that you can go in, and it's all warmed and everything, and it's fine, but it's a different experience. And I'm really happy that I did that, because it really felt like a proper Antarctic experience. But so that was so we get there, and you know, so the goal is you're going to be there for probably 48 to 72 hours. You know, you're going to get there, kind of get your bearings, go on, you know, they have a little bit of a training run you can do on the day, and then usually the next day is race day. So and then you leave the subsequent day. Well, so we get there, and first day's great. Then the next day, when we're supposed to race, there's a really bad glare. I mean, looking down at the snow, you couldn't make out any type of undulations or anything. So the visibility being so bad, they're like, we're going to have to postpone to the next day. And this is where it gets interesting, because certain people get really worried about it. But the race organizer, he always says, look, you should basically just plan that you could be down here for 5 to 7 days, because you're going to Antarctica. The conditions are variable. You know, some, you know, they do their best, you know, best possible effort to predict all of the forecast, but it's Antarctica. Weather can change hourly. It looks like we're going to be here an extra day. A couple of us are like, yes. A couple of people are like, I've got a flight out, you know, this and that. And it's like, well, that's why they tell you to, book flexible flights when you're coming down this way. And I did. And I had, like I said, I had had plenty of vacation. So I had budgeted an extra couple of days on the end. So I was fine. So we get through that day. And then the next day, weather clears up. But it's minus 20 degrees Celsius outside.
Holy cow.
With at one section, when you got to about the 5K mark of the race, there was this one mountain range where this katabatic winds would just come off of the South Pole, and it was picking up some wind. So it was like you got to the first aid station. So the aid stations were interesting because you can't put cold water out there. It's minus 20 degrees. So, all of the, you're drinking warm water. And if you have energy gels, it's good to keep them like on your person close to your body because they will freeze up as well too. And so we get to that first aid station drinking water, but the wind was just coming. And I felt for the staff that was just standing there, and they've got, you know, the big parkas on and full that. And so it was like, it was the quickest aid station I think I ever went to, because it was like, take the drink water and just keep moving. And thankfully, when you came around this one side, you got kind of into the protection of this other range from those winds. But that was at the beginning of the race, and it was pretty crazy winds. But then it became very still and just a sunny bluebird day in Antarctica. I think the unofficial term is that they call it a dingle day when it's beautiful sun, everything out there, and just sat there running in the quiet of Antarctica. And it was probably one of the best days of my life, to be honest.
How many people run it? How many people were with you?
It's capped 50 people. 50 okay. people can run it. So so it's not a big race. Obviously, they're trying to minimize the environmental impact, and they are very, the staff at Antarctic Logistics and Expeditions and the race organizer, Richard Donovan, who runs the Global Running and Polar Running Expeditions, they are very, very sad. I mean, it was to the point of where they told you, you know, don't stop for a bathroom break, because if you do, it's going to be there forever. So at about the 10K mark, they had taken a portable toilet. So, you know, you did have the option, but you just had to, you know, effectively it was 2 21K or 2 13 mile loops is what this race was. So about halfway through the loop, you had an option to do that. And they had also set up an emergency tent as well with some of the big sleeping bags and things like that. So if anybody started to get hypothermic or some bad weather came in, you did have a shelter to go into. Thankfully, no one needed any of that. Whilst it was cold, it was sunny. The winds had died down, so we didn't have to worry about that. And yeah, so, you know, running around, you know, with 50 people and, you know, it sounds like a lot of people, but you've got people of different levels of running, right? So we had a guy from Ireland who was, you know, 3 seconds out from making the Irish Olympic team who was running it. And then you had people that this was their first ever marathon, and they decided to just go all the way to Antarctica.
Oh my God, go big or go home.
First one ever. It was like, okay. Been like, it's all downhill from here, guys. You know, you've gone to the top, you know, so.
Except if you do the North Pole, I imagine.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's like some people are like, yep, this is my last. And some people are like, this is my first. It's like, okay, yeah, everyone's journey is different. So ran that. And, you know, it's funny with those races, they're not cheap races to get to. I took my time on it. And I said, I'm getting my value for my money on this race. You know, it's like, why go for a PB? Why go for a PB? You know, it's like not going to happen here anyway. So get your money for that. And enjoyed it. And it was, and again, I think one of the best things about doing a race like that in a small group in an extreme location is as I was mentioning earlier, the friends that you make, because, you know, everyone's been out there, they're running their own race. They talk about, oh my gosh, you know, it's like, did you see this? Did you see that? And to be honest, most of the people from that race, you know, we're all friends on Facebook. We all meet up at different races. You know, I've gone and visited people, they've come and visited me. It's just an amazing experience. And I think that camaraderie that you meet, that you feel with these people is important. So, right. So
a question I have for you. So were you, as you were fundraising money for your niece's cause, did you keep any kind of log for people who were donating? Any kind of log?
So what I was doing is I was promoting everything on Facebook and Instagram, and I have a website, you know, runovermld.com, and same, you know, runovermld is the challenge that I made for that. And so what I did is I was raising money at the time for a group called the MLD Foundation. And so they're based out of Oregon. The founders of that had some children that also had the disease as well. And so, so what I did for, you know, my fundraising is a lot of times, you know, you do fundraising and you never know where it goes or you don't really say. So I did a little bit differently. So I did like a t-shirt fundraiser thing. So I made some like Runover MLD t-shirts. And so like the first year in 2015, I just made some shirts that said Runover MLD and the MLD Foundation, stuff like that. And, you know, we raised probably around about 3,000 US at the time for that. And we were pretty happy with that, because the challenge with a rare disease is, you know, you hate to say rare diseases and popular diseases, because that doesn't sound, you know, great, but everyone has a cancer story. Everyone has a heart disease story. Everyone has a diabetes story or something like that. But when you talk about, have you heard of metachromatic leukodystrophy? People are like, I can't even say metachromatic leukodystrophy, right? It's a different class of diseases. And it can be, you know, I think 1 in 120,000 people could potentially have it. But the thing is, both parents have to have the recessive gene for that to happen. So that's what makes it rare. So getting people to get like energized for fundraising on that I found to be challenging on that. That's why I tried to do something a little different. Like, okay, I'm doing these shirts for these races that I did. And it seemed to work. And then in year two, when it was the extreme races, that's when Game of Thrones was kind of coming to be like, you know, its peak popularity. So, you know, the book for Game of Thrones is called A Song of Fire and Ice. So I made a shirt and it said Running Over Fire and Ice to fight MLD, you know, on it. And it was in the game, and it was in the Game of Thrones font, and it had the little like logo of the Hand of the King. And then on the back, I got permission from the organizer of the volcano, the Antarctic and the North Pole, to put the logos of their race on the back. And I put the MLD Foundation's logo on there as well too. And so they, you know, Those sold like hotcakes. Everyone's like, Game of Thrones shirt, great. You
know? So, that's awesome, though.
Yeah, so that definitely we raised you know, a couple grand off of doing that as well too. And it's great, because I went at the races, you know, I had some, and I said, oh, you can still order them, you know, from this thing. And what was great is I got a lot of the runners at Antarctica and the North Pole and the volcano to do it as well too, because they were like, oh, well, it's kind of like another souvenir shirt for my race, and it's for a good cause, and, you know, made a new friend, so it's helping him out. And, you know, then, of course, there's other people that are fundraising for whatever. I'll buy one of yours if you donate to mine. You know? And so it just kind of snowballed like that. And, yeah, it was really fun to do that. So, that was year two.
So which ones are we missing?
So the hardest.
Are you done with the seven?
So that was seven continents. That was seven continents. So finished Antarctica, got my seven continents medal. Got stuck another 2 days in Antarctica. Most of us were like, yeah, we're fine, because was funny. We were at the camp and it was sunny and blue, but 5-6 Ks away where the blue ice runway was, the winds were crazy and the plane couldn't come into land. So we got stuck another 2 days. So we were out there literally playing volleyball on the ice, you know, they set up a volleyball thing to, you know, did, but we couldn't fly out. And so we did that, spent a couple extra days, you know, bonded with new friends, and then went back to Chile and then made my long trip back home to Australia after that. And so then it was rest through the holidays, because that was in November of 2016, rest through the holidays, and then prepare for April of 2017, which was the North Pole Marathon, which was...
I can't even imagine. So how do you... Did you train with... I mean, you have them all really back-to-back, so I can't imagine there was a lot of training, training involved, other than running in the chamber with oxygen.
Like I said, it was for the Volcano Marathon, I had gone to that gym with the altitude chamber. So that was some specific training for that. But when it came to Antarctica, and then more specifically on the North Pole, Antarctica, again, it was on like a hard packed glacier. So yes, you're running on snow, but it was pretty steady underfoot on that. And it didn't get too chopped up. But then funny enough, there was a very inspiring lady named Heather Hawkins, who was a ovarian cancer survivor. And she lived in my suburb in Sydney. And I had seen that she had done the North Pole Marathon. So I reached out to her and said, hey, I live like literally like only 5 minutes away from you. Could we get together and chat and talk about this? And so she told me, she's like, if you really want to train specifically for the North Pole, because the North Pole and Antarctica are two totally different races, run on the beach. Run on sand. So living in Sydney, lived very close to the beach, took her advice. Every week I did 1 to 2 runs on the beach and ran on the sand, because up at the North Pole, it's not as dry, it's not as hard pack, it's more humid, and it's softer underfoot. And she said, when you start running this race, you know, the first lap's great, but, and we'll get to this in a minute, you're running, this is a very multiple lap course, and towards the end of the race, it's really chopped up, and you're going to be up to your ankles sometimes, you know, if you're unlucky, up to your knee in snow at times. And I was like, right, okay, she's done it, take her advice. So I did that, and I'm very glad that I did, because it made a difference later. But yeah, so the North Pole, that was kind of the next one, and which is another logistical just feat to get to.
Yeah, how long is it from Sydney?
Fly? Yeah, so from Sydney, we had to fly up to, we flew from Sydney to Singapore to Copenhagen, Denmark. And then, so to get to the North Pole, you have to leave from a Norwegian archipelago called Svalbard. So Svalbard is like there's a town called Longyearbyen, and that's the northernmost community in the world. So, like I said, it's a Norwegian principality. So we ended up having to fly from Tromsø, which is the northernmost city in Norway. So we made our way there. You know, had to go to Oslo, and Oslo to Tromsø, and then Tromsø up to Svalbard. So you get up to Svalbard, and it feels like you're on the frontier of the world. You're out there. It's just beautiful snow and glaciers and icebergs and everything. And the first thing you notice when you walk out the airport is, you know how there's like road signs that say, watch out for children, or watch out for animals, deer or cows, or something like that. So they've got the triangular sign and it's got a polar bear on it.
Oh my God.
And you're like, okay, yep. We're definitely in the Arctic Circle now. And the thing with Svalbard is, you know, in the town, you know, it's a little small township, you know, of Longyearbyen, you're fine. But if you leave the township, you don't leave without a rifle because polar bears are roaming around, you know, at different times of the year, more prevalent than other. In fact, I just read a story in the last, I think it was about 2 months ago, where unfortunately a polar bear was killed. There were some people that were camping and they weren't, you know, paying enough attention and they didn't have it. And a polar bear came in and, you know, doing what a bear does, looking for food, looking for everything. And they ended up mauling one person and they ended up in shooting it. So, I mean, that's the danger of being up in that area. And, you know, everything there is like the northernmost bar, the northernmost brewery, the northernmost this. So it was just an adventure just being in Longyearbyen in the city. And so from there.
Yep. What do people do in that town?
So Svalbard and Longyearbyen, it used to be, there was two things that were big up there. There was like a Russian mining operation that was okay. there for many years, which is closed down. And then whaling back when whaling was still a big thing up there. Those were the two things. Nowadays, it's more of an adventure base, if you will, or a tourist town. So a lot of people will go there for the Northern Lights to see the Aurora Borealis because it's beautiful up there. And in fact, the videographer for the volcano Antarctica and North Pole races, he's a Brazilian guy, funny enough, but he lived in Svalbard for a long time. And he still lives in Norway. He just recently moved, but he was up there and he was telling us, oh, you've got to go do this. It'll change your life. Or you've got to do this. It'll change your life. And it was life changing. We did a couple of snowmobile things and went on a hot air balloon in the Arctic Circle just to see the majestic nature of Svalbard. And even if you don't run the North Pole Marathon, just going to Svalbard, I would recommend that as a trip alone. And my wife and I, and there is a race, a Svalbard Marathon as well too, around the township, which makes me go, wow, okay, you're running and the threat of polar bears is there again too. And which
we have to run with a gun.
Well, we'll talk about the North Pole in a minute because that's not too far off. But yeah, so we get there and again, what was great is some of the people that I had met at some of these other races were also there because they were going for the same thing to finish their marathon grand slam or tick that off as well. And so it was good to have a reunion there. And so the interesting thing with the North Pole Marathon is that it's run at a Russian base called Camp Borneo. And the thing about Camp Borneo is it can only be operational for 1 month a year because they have to find a suitable ice flow that is strong enough to drop a tractor, drop fuel bins, do all this stuff so they can build a runway. So they have these small Antonov planes that are specialized for short takeoffs and landings. So you can land in. So they build this base, and similar to Union Glacier, it's like the Russians are there and there's Russian soldiers and don't know what they, you know, were up to. I know they do some maneuvers and training and stuff like that, but a lot of people that want to do what they call skiing the last degree. So the base is about at 89 degrees north. They will ski from Camp Borneo up to the geographic North Pole and do that. So that's kind of a thing for skiers. That's a tick box, you know, bucket list item for them as well. So you get there and it was a noticeable difference between the accommodation at Union Glacier, which was, I would call in the grand scheme of polar camping was 4 stars to probably what I would call more of a 2-star situation at Camp Borneo. And when I say that, it wasn't horrible or anything like that, but it was a noticeable difference. This was a military style camp versus you know, a private, you know, for-profit type of expedition place.
And, right, right.
So instead of having like individual tents, so in Antarctica, you shared a tent with one other person. And then here it was, you know, here's the male tent and here's the female tent. And there was like, it was kind of like bunks in there and perfectly warm, comfortable, things like that. But it was different. It was different overall. And you know, they had to, you know, melt some of the ice, you know, for water and things like that. And, you know, we brought a lot of, you know, we were told like, take your own food because, you know, Union Glacier, again, they've got chefs and things like that they bring down versus you're going to be eating some of the military stuff, which, you know, don't know if you want that or not. So it was like,
right before a marathon, right? You know,
yeah, right before a marathon, you really want to be eating, you know, military gruel, if you will. But, I brought like a lot of kind of those freeze-dried meals, you know, of like spaghetti, freeze-dried spaghetti. So you could just get hot water, pour it in there and just, you know, shovel it in before. So the interesting thing with this is obviously when you're in these polar areas, two things, 24-hour sunlight for one, because you're usually there in the summertime of whenever, whichever pole you're at. And you've got, like I said, short windows to get in and out. And so the North Pole is no different. And in fact, even maybe more extreme to that time. So it was, okay, it looks like we've got a 48-hour window to get in and out. So we're waiting. So they had to take two planes because it's a smaller plane. So the first plane goes, which I was actually happy about that I didn't go on that one because I could sleep in a little bit more. And the second plane goes. And before we left on the second plane, they go, well, we're looking at the conditions, guys. I think when you land, you're going to have about 2 or 3 hours and then we're going to race. It's like, okay. You look down at your watch and it's like, well, it's 4 p.m. now. That means we're going to get there at 10 p.m. So that means we're starting the race at midnight. Okay, that's another first, you know, starting a race at midnight. So we got there and, you know, met up with the other runners that had gone on the first flight. And, you know, they're all excited, like, oh, look, you know, it's amazing. We're, you know, just, you know, 1 degree off of the North Pole right now. And so we get there, we get ready, and then we start to notice, you know, there's the soldiers there with some rifles and then like that. And it's like, okay, we're going to do 13 4K loops of this because there's been some polar bears that have been spotted recently. So we don't want to keep, you know, we got to keep everyone within a small race. So, right. So during the race, there are people patrolling with rifles, you know, just in case a polar bear comes up. And they're not going to shoot the polar bear, right? They're going to just, you know, scare it away, you know, shooting
right,
into
right.
the air.
So, make noise, so, yeah.
There's no, you know, nothing, you know.
No animals were harmed in the making.
No animals were harmed in the making of this race. So.
So how many people were in
again, 50 people.
Okay,
yeah, so they limit those races to 50 people. And so. Two big differences between Antarctica and the North Pole. One, it was minus 40 degrees when we started the race. And minus 40 degrees is where Celsius and Fahrenheit meet each other, right? So brutally cold. You get out there and, you know, when you're running these races, you're not running in shorts and a tank top or singlet or anything like that. You know, we're running, you know, I had a base layer of, you know, thermal compression, 2x U-tights on. I had, you know, in Antarctica, I just had one thermal layer, thermal running top on. And then I had I had like a very Gore-Tex, like waterproof type of jacket, you know, a buff, a beanie, you know, ski. I had my snowboarding goggles on because the big problem is snow blindness. You have to run with a good lens or else if you run without it, you could get snow blindness, especially in Antarctica, the way that the sun reflects there. So we're getting there. And you know, like I said, Antarctica is a desert. So when you're breathing, your breath pretty much evaporates straight away with that. The North Pole, you're at sea level and it's very humid. So when your breath comes out, it's minus 40 degrees. It freezes almost immediately. So you can wear a face mask or a buff. And, you know, my Facebook photo is a picture of me at the end of the North Pole Marathon with my face mask on, and there's just icicles hanging down, you know, from it. Your eyelashes. You never thought, oh, well, okay, well, you know, you obviously sweat around your eyes when you're running. I had little icicles on my eyelashes, even with goggles on, and it makes the weirdest, like, sparkly kind of, it's almost like a movie when you see a sparkly thing going, you know, like a dreamscape going on. So I'm like running, and it's like, this is the weirdest thing ever. So, you know, you're running and you're dealing with this, and every lap, so like I said, it was 13 laps. I was, you know, I had brought multiple buffs and multiple face masks. I was popping into, you know, you could pop into the tent, the mess hall tent, and warm up, and you're doing this, and you know, I'm like, you know, taking like this frozen buff, like cracking it off my face and bringing it out. And then I had thrown this one old ski snowboard little face mask, looked like a ninja mask thing on, and it was too small for me. In fact, I believe it was my wife's at one time. And I was like, oh, this is the only thing I have left that's not frozen at the moment. So I put that on. And thankfully, with that one, I could do like two or three laps versus just every lap changing it out. But everyone was like hanging up their face masks and their buffs near these heaters to warm up and do that.
And now a message from our sponsors. The weather is getting cooler, days are getting shorter, and if you're an avid runner like me, it is now in the fall that we start struggling getting those runs in. The solution? Getting a Lifespan treadmill. It has truly changed my life. Now I can run in the comfort of my own home whenever it's convenient for me, and I don't have to worry about wind, cold weather, shorter days, anything really. Lifespan treadmills come with all the bells and whistles you want at an affordable price. Get yours following the link in the show notes below.
And so, you know, you're going and was, you know, so you're running on frozen ice, right? So you're not running on ground. So when you're running on it in the snow, you know, everyone's, you know, oh, may I don't know about everyone, but most people have walked through snow or have been skiing. So they kind of know the sound of what stepping on snow, and it makes this kind of rush sound.
Yeah.
But here you're running on the sea ice, and at some times it would make this like guttural sound, and you could kind of look over and you would see the ice and how it was kind of formed into these like pressure ridges and shapes, and you're like, I am not far from the water. You know, like there's not much between me running and this guttural sound, and it's like, is that just my foot on it, or is that cracking, you know, or what is it? And everyone told me they had the same thing. They're like, yeah, I didn't know if it was cracking or what that was. And so yeah, so you're running this. And like I said, it, you know, I made a rookie mistake, which was, so in Antarctica, I ran in my snowboard gloves, which were, you know, I had a set of glove liners, which were fingered. Not the mitten style, you know, individual fingers, and my snowboard gloves, which were individual fingers. That was a rookie mistake at that temperature, because you really need your fingers to be close together to keep each other warm. So pro tip, if you ever go to those really extreme Antarctic or Arctic races, use the mitten style gloves, because I ended up, by the end of that race, I didn't have feeling in the tips of my fingers, and I didn't get it back for almost 2 weeks. And so I didn't get frostbite, but it was the early stages of potentially getting it. And thankfully it all came right in the end. But yeah, so come towards the end of that race, I was, it took me just under 8 hours to do that one. That was tough. So you can imagine how that is. And there were some people that were out there a couple hours longer. And unfortunately there was one or two individuals that they had to pull off the course, because at, you know, the 12 hour mark, minus 40 degrees, they just really hadn't gotten around enough to where it was going to be safe enough. And the race organizer is very, very flexible on stuff, but safety is paramount, especially when you're in extreme things like that. And like in, when we were in Antarctica, he didn't have to pull anyone off, and he let people go, you know, but he was checking on them, you know, very regularly to make sure they weren't getting hypothermic or anything like that. But unfortunately, there were a few individuals at the North Pole that had to pull the pin early.
So did you have any food on your person, or did you just stop
I just stopped at that race. Okay. It was in Antarctica. I did, like I said, I kept some energy gels in an interior pocket so they would stay warm. And I had like a stroopwafel, like Dutch stroopwafels and things like that, which are good for energy. I had some of those, but in the North Pole, we kept everything inside of the mess hall tent because we knew it was going to be 13 4K loops. So we were going to pass it every, you know, a pretty reasonable, you know, interval.
Yeah,
so,
as well.
So we did that and kept it in there because it would have frozen pretty straight away on that. Right. And it was, yeah.
So that was
pretty special.
Do you feel do you notice you're sweating, or how's that feeling?
So it's kind of an interesting thing. You don't really notice until you stop. Okay. And that's one of the things that's pretty important in running in these types of conditions is if you stop, that's when you can get into trouble. Because if your body's staying warm and everything's kind of keeping going, it doesn't necessarily freeze. There's still the chance to freeze, but it's less likely chance. If you stop and you're just standing in minus 40 degrees, all of a sudden, you know, I think everyone knows from running, whenever you stop, you feel the sweat more than you do when you're actually running. Similar thing. You don't notice it so much, but then when you stop, you feel it. And what I did in Antarctica is at the halfway mark, I changed out my base layers. And when you're pulling them off, it's like, wow, okay, I didn't realize how sweaty this was on that. Because I think the course of your body trying to stay warm, it just doesn't really, really notice it. Same thing in Antarctica. I switched out about halfway. And it was, you know, extremely sweaty, and glad that I did it because at one point some of the winds did pick up and they were strong, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, I could feel it on my back, and it was like, oh, my back is like really sweaty and I noticed it with the wind going at. So it is definitely a challenge to find out what's that layering scheme that you want to have, and everybody's different. I mean, you know, I was running at the North Pole with, like I said, a thermal base layer. I had a fleece mid layer on and a Gore-Tex shell jacket on, a buff, two beanies, and then there was, you know, a couple of guys. There was a Nepalese guy and a Polish guy that were used to running in, you know, high altitudes or very, very frigid temperatures, and I think they had just two layers on the top, and they were getting around just fine. But yeah, different people, you know, used to different environments. It's it's definitely a thing, but if you do get into one of these races, I highly suggest there's always a lot of good information on recommended gear, and that's something I would highly recommend. And you know, shoe choices, yeah, everyone's very particular about shoe choices as well too, and definitely look for a Gore-Tex layered shoe, you know, trail running shoe, or ice running shoe. There's certain like Salomon and La Sportiva and some of the more trail running shoes out there. They make a lot of, and Hoka makes like Gore-Tex. They make Gore-Tex shoes with really good grip. In fact, I used a shoe called a Salomon Spike Cross, and they were essentially the Salomon Speed Cross trail running shoes, but they had small little spiked studs in the bottom, and those helped out tremendously. So
do you have a chip, or is this just
it's not, so they actually have yeah, so they're one of the race crew is there with you know, and they're checking they typically have a couple of people on the course, and they'll say, you know, number 43 has come through checkpoint one, you know, and then once they come around for these loops, they'll tick off, you know, okay, number 43 has come through lap number one or two or five or 12 or something like that. So yeah, it's a little bit more low tech than some of your big city races. So you have to deal with what you can on that. So
right. And then what happens when you finish? Do they have special food or?
Yeah, well, so the North Pole, yeah, from a food perspective, no, wasn't special.
Okay.
But the special thing about the North Pole race is when you're done and everyone's done, you get to take a helicopter ride to the actual geographic North Pole. And so all of us got up there, we rested, like I said, we were going to be there about 48 hours. So we probably, once it was all said and done, we had about a 6-7 hours of rest or so. And then we got to get into these, the military helicopters and actually go fly to the geographic North Pole. And so we found it with GPS because the geographic North Pole is always moving. And you're on an ice floe as well too. So it's a challenge. So we went and we found it with GPS. And we put a sign in the ground that said North Pole. And, we all chased each other around every time zone in the world in like 10 seconds, being at the top of the world. And the joke at the top of the world is, they say, well, what time zone is the North Pole? And they say, there's no time zone because it's every time zone. And so that was better. And it was even colder there. It was minus 50 degrees when we got out at the North Pole. And so that was, the excitement of being there, I think, took away some of the actual just bitterness of that cold. And it was pretty special to kind of really finish it off literally at the top of the world. And because you felt that way, that you were at the top of the world from running that. So it was, that was a pretty special day. And then we went back to the camp. And then again, it was having to be two planes. So again, if you were on the first plane up, you're on the first plane back. And funny enough, I think it was the majority of the ladies were on the first plane. There was only like one or two ladies on that. So then it was one of the things, we started seeing some of the Russians with chainsaws out on the ice, cutting into the ice. We're like, what are these guys doing? Like, are they gonna do some experiment? Or are they gonna go scuba diving? What are these military guys doing? We don't know what they're doing. So then we noticed they started cutting out a pool in the ice, and they were gonna start doing polar plunges. So we had like 5 or 6 hours to kill, and it was like, you speak Russian? No. Do you speak Russian? No. Do you speak Russian? No. Go talk to the guy, see what he's doing, see if he speaks English. So one of the guys, I think it was one of the French guys, went over and chatted to him and said, oh, are you making a pool? Can we, can we jump in, and so we can do the polar plunge, so we can say we've been in every ocean also in the world too. So we can say we've been in, we've done all 7 continents, we've done the North Pole, now we've swam in every ocean. And so yeah, they were like, oh yes, you can do this. So what they did is they had actually probably cut about it was probably just up above my knees pool. So cut a rectangular pool, but then they had taken this drill and drilled all the way down into the ice. So the water would kind of come up through this one hole and fill this pool up. So then it was the funniest thing, because it was, the first guy, I'll do it if you do it. I'll do it if you do it. I'll do it if you do it. And so everyone was kind of pairing up as they're like, their inspiration of doing it. So what they did is they had this sauna tent is what I'll call it. So they had a tent, they put this little sauna heater in, and you went in, and you were only there in your underwear, and you warmed up really warm, and they had like warm water that you put your feet in the warm water. And so we went through, and the first couple people go, and it's like, yeah, I did it, And so we started what we called the North Pole Swimming Club, or the North Pole Surf Life Saving Club. And to join the club, you had to go into the pool, but not only just get your feet in, you had to go under, fully under the water. And so it was so funny, because, we had one guy who was like opening the door to the tent, and it'd be like, and now coming out from Australia, Chris, and you'd open the tent door and he'd come out like, yay. And run in, and you know, dunk your head under the water and then run as quickly as you could back into that sauna tent and dry off. And so, you know, and the funny thing was, is that, you know, there was probably only about, you know, there's maybe 20 of us there, but there was probably 5 towels. You know, it was like, okay, we got to figure out some sort of assembly line here. How, okay, if you've used this towel, then it goes and gets close to the heater and gets warmed up. So then 5 people later, right, it's warm. So then this guy can do it. So we had this like assembly line going, and we had, you know, a couple of the people, they were being the videographers and this and that. So that was what we did to kill the time between waiting for the plane to come back. And then when we got back to Svalbard, they were like, what did you guys get up to? Why you had to wait for 5 or 6 hours there? And we were like, well, let us tell you what we did. We, you know, we all went for a polar plunge. And then everyone that was on the first plane was insanely jealous that we did that.
Oh my God, I would have been. Yeah. Oh my God, that's crazy.
So yeah, so that's how we finished it off, and then got back and, you know, saw my wife, and it was, you know, told her all about it. She was pretty cool, you know, pretty excited for me. And it was one of those moments where you're like, wow, okay, this 3-year journey is just completed. You know, what do you do next? And funny enough, I had gotten a spot in the London Marathon, which was 2 weeks later. So it was like, time to rest. And then 2 weeks later, make our way to London. So it was like, it was kind of hard, you know, to process finishing 7 marathons in the North Pole, because it was like, I still had, you know, we were taking a week of driving through Finland and then make our way to London for the London Marathon after that. And funny enough, I ran the London Marathon in literally half the time it took me to do the North Pole Marathon. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was good training when you put your body through something so extreme.
Yeah.
Everything else is
easier. It did feel that way. It did feel that way. I just remember walking through the London Marathon Expo with the North Pole shirt on, like, man, this isn't nothing.
Yeah. And here I am just thinking, if I could qualify for Boston, it's like,
yeah. Yeah. You know, and to be honest, that was my dream and as well too. And I kind of, you know, to give you, I've kept running, you know, for Run Over MLD, and I've started working with another charity called Cure MLD. And in January I went to Houston, my hometown, where my niece lives, and I ran the Houston Marathon, because I've never run a race in my hometown before. And I ended up qualifying for Boston. So
good for you. Congratulations. Yeah.
Now that's awesome. All in flux with the world today and the pandemic and everything about how the race this year didn't happen, and one knows what's going to happen for next year's race. So fingers crossed that my January 2020 qualification time will somehow get me into a Boston Marathon. But I'm resigning myself that it's like, okay, well, I might have to try and qualify again. But thankfully, I'm about to click over into the next age group, so I'm going to get an extra 5 minutes. So which makes a world of difference. I'm in the 40 to 44, and it was 3:10. I did 3:04:24, so I had like a 5.5 minute buffer, which at the time in January I was like, yes, that's going to get me in. Now it's like, all bets are off. You know, who knows what it means. So
yeah, I don't know what they're gonna do. They're probably gonna require people to qualify again. That would be my guess.
Who knows? And that's what I'm setting myself up for. I know there's gonna be a lot of disappointed people out there, but it is what it is in the world today. So right. Yeah, Boston qualification was as probably next to finishing all 7 in the Marathon Grand Slam at the North Pole. Yeah, this year, finishing it in Houston, finishing it with my family, you know, because we had my family came out, got to spend it with my niece. It's the first race that I've been able to actually see her in person after a race, instead of just on FaceTime or Zoom or something like that. And so that was pretty special, and we'll see what happens.
How's your niece doing right now?
Yeah, look, so the thing with these diseases is they are terminal. You know, a lot of these rare diseases, they're terminal. There is no cure. So I like to say every day she's here is a great day. There is a noticeable decline that happens.
How old is she?
So she just turned 9 this month. So, So, you know, she was diagnosed in April, or in just after Easter around 2014. It was about that time. And so they usually say, you know, there's two types of diagnosis. You can get what's called the infantile, which is typically when they're a baby, or the juvenile, which can happen in the teenage years. The infantile metachromatic leukodystrophy, it doesn't have a very long lifespan. So the fact that she's 9 right now is amazing, because many children don't live past their 5th or 6th birthday. So there's been a few children, and there's been some advances in the treatment and starting to learn how to treat the symptoms and to live with it more, because that's really what you have to do is live with it, because you can't cure it. You know, you can treat symptoms, but you can't cure the disease. So she's doing, you know, as best as we could ever hope for right now. But, you know, we're mindful that every day is a good day on that. Usually people that get the juvenile diagnosis in their teenage years, they can live for quite a long time. There's people that have been diagnosed in their juvenile years that are in their 30s right now and have it. Again, it is degenerative, so similar to like ALS or you know, motor neuron disease. It you know, your body atrophies, you lose motor functions, the ability to talk, the ability to eat. So you have to have feeding tubes. You know, people to take care of you and things like that. So it's, you know, it is an absolutely devastating disease for those that have it. And you know, there are treatments. Yeah, there are treatments that can be done. So there are some gene therapies that are being trialed right now. And the thing is that if it's caught early enough when you're an infantile, diagnosis, the gene therapy has been proven to help slow it down. It's not necessarily known if it's a complete cure, but it's definitely slows down the progression of the disease. And so there's a lot of trials going on in Italy, and then there's some, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, that is one of the best hospitals in the world for rare diseases, and especially MLD. And the charity that I'm working for right now, Cure MLD, is actually based out of Pennsylvania as well. So they're very closely affiliated with that. So one of the things that, you know, raising money for what's helped with Cure MLD is that they will help families with the costs that it takes to get to CHOP, because people could, you know, live everywhere, and there's this one hospital in the world that's a specialist there. So they give grants to families to come out to CHOP and pay for their airfare and their accommodation. Just, it's one less thing, because I mean, healthcare, as we know, is in many parts of the world, in the U.S., it's outrageously priced, and especially when it comes to be something rare like this, where they're specialists, it's you know, it's not cheap. And so that's one of the things that why I've been so excited about working with Cure MLD, is because they do this, and they are, you know, it's very tangible things. You know, other foundations do great work, but it tends to be on the back end of things that people can't see, you know, like lobbying to politicians or doing things like that. It's very tangible, and you see the results. And like, so when I just ran the Boston or just ran Houston for my Boston qualification, we raised, you know, a couple thousand dollars for Cure MLD, and they were actually, the money straight from that was going to a family from Brazil to be able to fly up to CHOP to go through some of these diagnosis and screenings and things like that. So it felt really good to know that, yep, that's where donations go for, because yeah, there's so many amazing organizations out there for many charities out there, but it does feel like sometimes, where does my charity money go? does it go to some administrative cost? Does it go to this? What does it go to? I really like some smaller charities where, you know, the money is going to be a tangible benefit to somebody in need.
Right. So if people here listening to this wanted to help out, where should they go?
Look, you know, you can go to my website, which is runovermld.com. And there's a link on there to where you can donate to Cure MLD. Or you can go to curemld.com, which is their website as well too. Either way, it gets you to the same place. There, you know, Maria Kafalis, who's one of the founders of that, her daughter, Cal Calliope, she has, she's also living with MLD right now. Very inspirational people. She's someone that is very passionate about this. And very just passionate about helping other people. And the thing that I think you learn from, you know, a journey like this is, and you meet these people and, you know, it's very similar to runners, right? When runners have been to a race, they want to tell you about it. And, oh, next time if you go, you should do this because I didn't do this right or I didn't do that. It's the same way within the rare disease community because they sometimes feel that they're alone. They feel like they're the only one because, you know, like I said, everyone has a cancer story. Not everyone has a rare disease story. So, you know, these communities, you know, rare disease communities, they really need that assistance very much. And it goes to that helping. And Maria, the founder, she's one of these people where she just wants to take her experiences and help other people out. And like I said, that's what's inspired me to partner with Cure MLD continuing to partner with them. And we'll do so pretty much forever, as long as I can run. So probably even after that.
Very good. So if someone has questions about Seven Continents Challenge or the North Pole, where can they connect with you? Do you have an Instagram account?
Yep. So Instagram, Runover MLD, or on Facebook, you can look at Runover MLD as well too. I'm happy to share all the rookie mistakes that I made in all of these races. you know, I'm still here to talk about it, which is good, but definitely, you know, if I did it over again, hindsight is definitely 20/20 on certain things. But yeah, reach out. I'm always happy to talk about it. Happy to help anyone out and give any advice that I can.
Thank you so much for giving us your time. I really enjoyed this conversation.
All right. Thanks a lot, Susie. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Chris. Don't forget to visit the Iron Things community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And please come back to listen to more episodes. As always, run fearless, you guys.